It was all over in 5 seconds with 5 moves on my mother's part. Move 1. Push Jenny to safety with the left hand. Move 2. Pull the right hand holding the Coke bottle away from Jelly's grip. Move 3. Grab the Coke bottle out of the right hand with the left hand. Move 4. Swing the Coke bottle downward and break it against the curb. Move 5. Swing the broken Coke bottle upward and damn near slice Jelly Bean's arm off. Jelly Bean sped away as I peeped around Mama. I saw a trail of blood leading to the corner where the station wagon had been parked. And in a town as small as Kinloch, we never saw Jelly Bean again. Mama looked at me and said, "Come on." Eyes crossed, I grabbed Mama's hand, plugged my mouth with my thumb, and we continued to walk in silence down that rocky road. All I could think was, where the fuck is my last swallow of Coke? Mama changed my birth certificate so she could enroll me a year early. Hence, I was always a year younger than my classmates. My teachers loved me and validated me. I was often called to stand and come forward in class. I was far from a great student, but I was Miss Personality, the class clown, and a natural leader. I was a shining light at school most of the time. Whenever I would bring a sad mood into the classroom, my teachers would notice and listen to me. That's all I really needed. I joined the Brownies and every after-school activity available. It kept me out of the house where Mama was often on the warpath. She'd be bone-tired from cleaning 2 or 3 houses on the weekend or working 8 hours at the hospital and then taking a long bus ride home, only to have to feed us, wash, iron, and sort out how to pay the bills. She was not in the mood for childish foolishness, and I was an overactive, needy kid. My poor siblings bore the brunt of my hyperactive, mischievous ass. When they'd sit on the floor playing Monopoly, I was left out because I didn't have the attention span for anything as boring as a board game. So I'd make sure Mama wasn't around. And then, ever on a search and destroy mission, I'd run across the board howling, "I hate y'all!" as the pieces scattered. Fortunately, my energy was channeled into sports, and I was a pretty good athlete. Still, I often cheated, even going so far as to steal the blue ribbon from the judge's table at a track meet. I felt being number 1 would gain more attention from my mother. But even when I brought home a blue ribbon, her praise felt short-lived. Mama might smile at our achievements, but she always had other fish to fry. When I was 9, Mama moved us to a house on Jackson Street. It was certainly a step up. We were overjoyed to have hot water and indoor plumbing. Life seemed to finally settle in for my family, especially because Mama's scrimping and saving meant she came home more often with bags full of groceries, giving us a welcome break from the powdered milk, lard, and blocks of government cheese. The Jackson House is where I began impersonating movie stars and recreating the dance moves I saw done by the Supremes and the Temptations on TV shows like American Bandstand and The Ed Sullivan Show. I learned to curse in the house on Jackson, too. But I was careful. I knew a bad word could get a severe beating from Mama. The house on Jackson is where I first found myself overcome by sadness at night. I didn't think about where the sadness came from or tell anyone. I would just cry into my pillow or while I sat alone in the bathroom. To try to gain control, Sometimes I would sing mournful Mahalia Jackson songs that I loved so much. The evening before my 10th birthday, we were hosting a meeting of the church's youth group. Mama sent me to the kitchen to wash dishes. As I turned on the faucet, a siren pierced the air, and seconds later, every church bell in town began to ring. We Midwesterners knew what was coming. The lights flickered. I looked out the kitchen window, and the sky turned black. Then the biggest flash of lightning I'd ever seen illuminated the magnificent funnel itself. I felt suspended in a dead, quiet calm until the tornado, sounding like a roaring locomotive, snapped me into action. I ran through the short hallway toward the group in the living room as we were overtaken by an unforgettable whooshing noise. The house lifted off its foundation, dumping the youth group kids out of their chairs and onto the floor. In the darkness, Mama shouted, "Get to the basement!" We started to run through the kitchen to the basement stairs, but stopped when a lightning flash showed us the glasses and dishes I had been washing swirling around in midair, then shattering against the wall. We huddled in the hallway, praying, crying, and screaming as hail as large as grapefruit pounded the roof and spears of wood pierced the walls as if God were using our house for target practice. Finally, silence. That horrifying calm after the storm. The transistor radio told us we had survived a record-setting winter F4 tornado. 3 people were killed in the St. Louis area. The next morning, Kinlock was in shambles. Our house and our neighbor, Miss Woods, got the worst of it. It was the wood from her roof that had splintered and pierced our house. It looked like a porcupine. But I was not about to let a tornado get in the way of my birthday. I trailed Mama through the mess, humming, whistling, and singing so she could remember that this was my special day. It worked, and I took my $5 straight to Miss Bubble's Chinese restaurant. The owner, whose real name was Maddie Sue, had lived in faraway Chicago. And when she came back with the fried rice. You had to go down a cobblestone alley to the back of her house to order through a kitchen window. I used to love hopping from stone to stone to get a quart-sized cardboard carton of egg foo young and fried rice. Chinese soul food style. Ultimately, our house was condemned. We moved into a house on Schoolway into another basement. It was sort of a step backwards because once again we had to use an outhouse or the tin bucket. We kids rushed out of the house every day because the last one out had to dump the bucket in the outhouse. Mama left for work before us and she'd say, "I don't care who does it, but that bucket better be clean when I get home." The task was especially humiliating because we were in full view of Kinlock High School across the street. To this day, my siblings tease me with, "Jenny, you never took out the bucket." And to this day, I still respond with, "But I'm the baby." One good thing about the house on Schoolway was Waletra lived upstairs with her husband and children, and I began to experience the joys of being an aunt to little Peppy and Wally Bear. But the best thing was there was no trees or bushes around, Mama couldn't easily go out and pull a switch. She took to beating us with a fly swatter. At least that didn't hurt as much. By sixth grade, I had acquired a reputation as a charmer and a fighter, much in the tradition of my mother. With the kids on the block and at school, I was large and in charge. I had authority. When Sheila Williams damn near split open her head 'cause she tripped on the double Dutch rope, they brought her to me to see what should be done. I had no sway in Mama's house, but in the street, I was determined to be the boss. People in Kinloch survived by being strong. Sometimes that strength creates a culture where the response to every challenge is, "Okay, let's take this shit outside." You step to people before they step to you. Come on, jump in my chest and make a bird's nest, was what was said when we were about to fuck somebody up. It meant, "Bring it, bitch, I'm ready." I was often quite the bully, but really had little to back up my sharp tongue and controlling behavior. Sometimes I got in over my head. I teased Yvette about a rash on the back of her neck. The next day, I carried a kitchen knife, anticipating the after-school fight. I didn't know how to use it, but I was going to try if I had to. A bunch of girls followed me home, with Yvette leading the pack and determined to kick my ass. Just so happened that my daddy was riding by in his friend's car when he saw the crowd of kids. He looked a little closer and saw that it was his baby about to get a beatdown. Despite swinging a knife at her would-be attackers, he stepped right in and carried me out of there. To hear me tell the story the next day at school, I kicked butt and took names. See, I had the personality to convince everyone that I had won the fight. Through my involvement with the YWCA and the Girl Scouts, I entered talent shows in Kinloch and the greater St. Louis area and usually won. I was gaining a reputation as a singer, and when our choir visited other churches, I became the most requested soloist. These experiences were proof for me that I actually had the talent to become a star. Around this time, I started to sneak out of the house to go to the movie theater in nearby Ferguson. My siblings and friends warned me not to go to Ferguson. It just wasn't safe for black folks. But see, Ferguson had a movie theater, and Kinloch did not. I would save a couple of dollars, get on the bus, and spend hours alone in the dark watching movies like Hello, Dolly! And Sweet Charity, which left a lasting impression on me. I could see my future self. And she was on screen, and she was glamorous, just like Barbara Streisand and Paula Kelly. During my adolescence, we moved into a new house where I finally had my own room. Well, sorta. It was also the bathroom for the whole household. But it did have a curtain to separate me from the toilet. Our house always had an undercurrent of tension, fear, and rage. There were mornings when Mama entered my room, pulled the bedclothes off me, and beat me for some infraction the night before. I was often miserable at home. When I wasn't crying alone at night, I prayed hard for Jesus to come and make everything right. And then, of course, there was church. The First Missionary Baptist Church of Kinloch, Missouri. We had to attend every function. Sunday school, Bible study, choir rehearsal, junior usher board meetings, and on and on. Church turned out to be a refuge for me, because I found many kind women there who took me under their wings, including Miss Parks, head of the usher board, and of course my great aunts Ida and Membry. In addition to singing in the choir, I energetically joined in on all sorts of tasks and projects, basking in the smiles and praise of these substitute mothers. First Baptist Church was full of drama, much of it revolving around competition for the pastor's attention. My mother, like so many women in the church, was in love with her pastor. The pastor was like the chief of the village, infallible like the Pope. Women who lacked support and love, who yearned for husbands and self-esteem, often filled the void with church. The problem is that many pastors know this all too well and take full advantage. It's a tired old story that's been played out forever. My mother maintained good friendships and an active social life in and outside of church. In 1962, she was the founding member of the Wild Rose Social Club, a dozen women who would get together regularly for the next 50 years. These were hard-working women who cherished a few hours a month to socialize and sip cocktails. And baby, the Wild Roses were fabulous. They would work to outdress each other, usually in outfits they had whipped up on their Singer sewing machines. I dreamed of being as stylish, hip, and fun-loving as these ladies. When the club met at our house, Mama would sometimes call me in to demonstrate the new dances, like the jerk and the funky four corners. Not to be confused with the boring-ass regular four corners. The night I showed them the boogaloo, I knew Mama was proud of me, but also knew she wanted to be the one in the spotlight. Nearly 40 years later, Mama said as much when she came to see me in Hairspray on Broadway. When someone asked how she enjoyed my performance, her response was, "She may have the money, but I'm the one that's funny." In junior high school, when I was elected class president, I began keeping a journal as an organizing tool. I'd note who would bring the soap and rags to the car washes at the local gas station, whose mama would bake a cake for the bake sale, and who would bring the record player and 45s for the dance in the basement of the YWCA, and who had lost their virginity. As seventh grade class president, I was chosen, along with a boy in my class named Lanier, to go on a trip to Okolona, Mississippi, with our teachers, Miss Downey and Mr. Griffin. During the trip, I decided Lanier would be the one to take my virginity. We were staying at the home of a cow farmer. Lanier and I walked out into a cow patch, started fooling around, and were soon naked. Lanier sat in an old worn chair that was leaning against a poplar tree, and I straddled him like I knew what I was doing. He had a dick as hard as the stolen obelisk robbed from the Temple of Karnak that now stands shamelessly in the heart of Paris. I lowered my body onto his. An unexpected pain shot through me. I saw blood and thought I was gonna die. Nobody had told me about this part. I had absolutely zero sex education. Once I got over the pain, I began to like it. I felt like I had conquered. Like I was in control. Later that semester, I started organizing talent shows in the basement of the Catholic school. I'd both emcee the shows and perform. I'd do two songs, let somebody else sing half a song, then I'd come back to do three more. If a song in my act had multiple parts, I'd do them all. At any given time, 50 or more people would pay 35 cent admission. Like I said, I admit I took all the proceeds and went straight to Miss Bubbles for some fake Chinese food. Everyone at John F. Kennedy Junior High School knew I could sing, and that Aretha was my favorite. One day, Mr. Santos, who was one of the few non-African American teachers, saw me with my head down on my desk, crying. "What's wrong, Jennifer?" I raised my head and said, "I'll never hit those high notes like Aretha Franklin. I'll never be famous." He smiled gently and continued the lesson. 3 days later, as we changed classes after the bell, Mr. Santos called after me in the hallway. He looked strange. Both shaken and smiling. It was weird, and I drew back a little when he started to speak. "Last night, when I was washing dishes, I broke a plate. It broke into several pieces. As I bent to pick up the pieces, I had a vision. You will be known, Jennifer. You will be famous in this world." Mr. Santos' vision wasn't enough. "Do you think I can be a star?" was the question I asked every authority figure, including our pastor. I was in the front seat of his car getting a ride back to Kinloch from the youth choir's visit to a church in the city. Riding with the pastor was a feather in my cap. Anybody would jump at the chance to ride with Pastor Hurd. After I asked the question, my pastor pulled the car over to the side of the road and stopped. He leaned over to me and suddenly pressed his lips to mine. I clenched my teeth and leaned away from him. He persisted in trying to push his tongue between my teeth. He groped for my breast with the hand he wasn't sliding over my shoulder. I tightened up, pressing myself backward as far as the car door would allow. I pushed against his shoulders, and he finally stopped. He scooted back to his place behind the wheel and said nothing as he drove onto the freeway. As we got closer to home and he slowed the car onto an exit ramp, I opened the door on the passenger side to spit. I had been holding it back for as long as I could, disgusted by the taste of his mouth. He must have thought I was going to jump out. He grabbed me by my left arm. I snatched my arm from his hand and thought, "Don't touch me, motherfucker!" But I didn't say anything. I had been conditioned to respect and revere my elders, especially my pastor. I told Mama as soon as I got home. She looked at me and said, "Go to your room." About 10 minutes later, she came to my room, pulling the telephone extension cord as far as it could reach. When she got to my doorway, she aimed the receiver at me. She had called Pastor Hurd. "Now tell him," she said, "what you told me." I took the phone. But before I could say anything, she snatched the receiver out of my hand. walked into her bedroom, and closed the door. I was devastated, betrayed by my pastor and my mother. By the time I entered Kinloch High School, my brothers and sisters were either working or in college or married. The house was quieter. I had fewer people to hide behind, so I spent most of my time trying to avoid my mother. My teachers at Kinloch High School knew about me before I even got there. As my friend Rose Wilson put it, "You were number one, Jennifer, our role model. We wanted to be you." I soon ruled high school as much as I had junior high. I was bossy, but not mean. I was captain of the cheerleaders, and no school could bring it like the Kinloch High Squad. And of course, yours truly made up all the cheers. "Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. We hate to beat you, but we must. We must." For the fourth year in a row, I was elected president of my class. I was fine with my grades, but never got straight A's like my sisters. We were living in times of great upheaval and promise. A spirit of rebellion could be felt everywhere. The civil rights movement had won some big battles, and the Black Power and anti-Vietnam War movements were ever present, even in our small town and even smaller school. Racism hit close to home when some men from Kinloch went fishing in Illinois. They never returned, and we heard they'd been lynched by the Ku Klux Klan. We never felt far from the threat of those hooded murderers. "Free Angela" was our rallying cry when I staged a walkout in the 10th grade in support of Angela Davis, the brilliant young university professor and revolutionary, whose huge afro and mini skirts were unforgettable in the photos that captured her on the news. Davis's image hung in the homes of Black people as a hero, and in the post office on the FBI list of the 10 most wanted fugitives. Now, in January 1972, Davis was being held without bail on charges of murder and conspiracy because she had purchased guns that were used in the courtroom shootout in Marin County, California, about a year and a half earlier. The shootout took place during the trial of George Jackson, a Black Panther and political prisoner who became famous as one of the Soledad brothers. Angela wasn't a member of the Panthers. She was in the Communist Party, which was just as bad in the eyes of the FBI. She was also in love with the compellingly brilliant Jackson, who died along with five others in the courtroom tragedy. Mind you, I had no knowledge of these details when I organized the walkout. I knew that Angela was a powerful Black woman. I loved her afro, and had begun to wear one myself a few months earlier, as had my mama and some of my sisters. When I heard about the nationwide protest on the Black radio station that morning, I was ready. With my big mouth and social power, it wasn't hard for me to get most of the students out of their seats. When Davis was acquitted of all the charges a few months later, I don't think I was even aware of it. I was consumed by a million activities for church and school, staying out of the house as much as I could. There was one teacher who didn't like my take-charge attitude and tried to take me down a peg when she could. She took my gym uniform and threw it on top of the lockers where I couldn't find it. Losing possession of your uniform could earn you an F. Now, I had put my uniform on the bleachers next to my books while I went out in the hallway and held court with some fellow students. When I went back to get my stuff, my books were there, but my uniform was gone. Now, my name was sewn inside the collar, so I knew no one had stolen it. After looking everywhere, I climbed on a chair so I could see the top of the lockers. My uniform lay in the dust and cobwebs. I was mad, but I shook the dust off and emerged with my uniform looking sharp and my nicely shaped afro intact. Journal entry. Got her ass, bitch. I am Dorothy Mae Lewis's daughter. You can't come for me and win. Just before my junior year, my mother's hard work and determination paid off in a big way. Jackie, Robin, and I discovered there was an empty split-level house on Smith Street. It belonged to a man who bought it for his family shortly before he lost his job. As a consequence, he had to sell the house. In the days after Mama learned this, she prayed that she could qualify to buy it. She had been saving money while trying to get us into a housing project, but she heard someone had blackballed her. Her application for the project apartment was rejected. But she got a mortgage to buy the house. She cried some happy tears then. The house was brand new, with four bedrooms and not one, but two bathrooms. I shared with Robin, who was on her way to Lincoln University in Jefferson City, Missouri. Bertrella and Larry were already attending Lincoln. Well, Latrell had moved out of Kinloch with her husband, David, a Baptist minister. Bay Bruh was at Florissant Valley Community College, and Jackie got married shortly after we moved in. I found my first job with the Neighborhood Youth Corps, cutting weeds, clearing lots, and picking up litter. From time to time, I would babysit with Latrell's children. One of the kids broke my mother's stereo. My mother said to me, "You're gonna pay for that." I responded with, "No, I'm not." She slapped me and said, "You forgot who you were talking to." I was so mad I was ready to walk. I had saved $30 and planned to take a bus somewhere. Sister Robin was sitting in a lawn chair reading a magazine when I walked down the driveway with my stuff packed. She didn't even look up when she said, "Jenny, don't do it." She knew that if I walked out of that yard, Mama would come for me and it would not be pretty. The fall of my senior year, I sought to complete my perfect record as class president for 6 years straight. My opponent, Dickie, one of my 90 cousins, was the smartest in our class, but I figured I was a shoo-in to win. I was the one who ran the car washes and bake sales that funded our junior prom. For years, I had organized our dances, and as a consequence, I had to work through them while the other students partied. I figured the classmates who liked me would surely vote for me, and the ones who didn't would be too scared not to. When the votes were counted, I had won, but only by one vote. Again, I felt betrayed. I cussed out several friends for their lack of loyalty. That night, I cried myself to sleep as I thought about what happened. But I didn't need a reason to cry into my pillow. It had become habitual. Comforting, almost. Here I was, the shining star at school, but racked by sadness at night. I was disappointed that my prayers to Jesus had been unanswered. It made me feel unworthy. I began to pray to my friends, in particular Mary. Unlike Jesus, she at least seemed to like me. Midway through my final semester, I met a guy at the Northland Mall. He was a few years older, wore a sharp blue suit, and had a gold front tooth, and was called, wait for it, Goldie. I was enthralled. We went on a few dates, and he taught me how to drive. He asked me for money, telling me he needed $50. I gave him $35. It made me feel even closer to him. Finally, I went to his apartment and we had sex. I couldn't feel his small penis. I actually couldn't tell if it was in or not. Midway through, I felt him doing something down there, but I couldn't tell what. Later, I figured out he had broken the condom. My guidance counselor, Miss Butler, gave me the moral support I needed when I went to her crying about my plight. She helped me arm myself to tell my mama. The first thing I said to mama was, "It's gonna cost $200, but I have it from the gifts." A few teachers had given me money for my upcoming graduation. They were women of modest means themselves, but they held great hope for me. They believed in my dream. Of course, Mama was disappointed, but she didn't dwell on it. I guess she sort of expected it. I wasn't valedictorian. Dickie was. But I was chosen as one of the speakers at our graduation. It was a crowning achievement for a girl who'd been elected class president, voted class clown, and most likely to succeed, and dubbed the loudest. What a surprise! I delivered my speech with all the fervor and dramatics that I could. I stood before my classmates and their families, my fists raised. Now is the time to move forward and go out into the world, I proclaimed. 2 months later, I left Kinloch for Webster College and my life ahead. The summer after my freshman year at college, Mama wanted me to come home, but I felt my place was out in the world. Not back in Kinloch. I decided to stay on campus and get a job at a nearby McDonald's. After 2 days of cleaning toilets and mopping floors, I begged the manager to change my duties because I'm going to be famous. He assigned me to bun detail. All I had to do was lower the toaster onto the buns, wait for the beep, remove the toasted buns, put the next batch in, and lower the toaster again. Easy enough. But then I began telling my co-worker at the beverage station about my future as a movie star. I described the songs I would sing, the shows I would do, and the awards I planned to win. The toaster beeped, and I lowered it while continuing to talk. It beeped again, and I lowered it again, never missing a beat in my monologue about my future success. Well, suddenly, flames shot out of the toaster, and the buns turned to charcoal because I had lowered the toaster on the same batch about 4 times. Well, I was fired on the spot. After that, ladies and gentlemen, I never had a job outside of show business again. Kinlock receded into my past as the years rolled by. I grew closer to my siblings and was grateful when I could make it home for family reunions, kids' birthday parties, and graduations. I returned for the sad times as well. Years later, when I was living in Los Angeles, the phone rang at 5 a.m. It was my niece calling from Dallas, Texas. She said, "Aunt Jenny, my daddy had a heart attack this morning." And then she screamed, "And he didn't make it." I, of course, flew immediately home to comfort my mother and siblings. Dear God, our Babra, Edward James Lewis Jr. was gone. Babra and I were never super close, but in my travels, I would always plan a layover in Dallas to visit him and his beautiful sweet wife, Annette, and their amazing 2 children, Eddie and Ashley. At Babra's burial in Texas, I admitted to the crowd that I had stolen quarters out of the drawer where he kept his tips from working at the Ramada Inn during 1966. I apologized to him that day, confessing I had been driven to the crime by my addiction to Hostess Twinkies. 10. It ain't that kind of call, motherfucker. 15 years had passed since I had left my hometown when Rachel, my therapist, began to help me explore the details of my childhood and my relationship with my mother despite my protests. At this point, Kinlock was a ghost town, sold off to the airport and its residents scattered around the country. Rachel had broken the shell. She cracked me open with her questions. And over the next few months, I began to talk about my mama. Rachel did not see me as an alpha woman, head cheerleader, a Broadway star with ferocious talent. She saw me as a little girl stuck in childhood pain. Her sympathetic response allowed me to begin to trust her and the process. I felt that Rachel liked me and that she could and would help me find those answers I'd been seeking for so long. To say therapy was difficult is an understatement. The sadness and anger I felt while talking to Rachel permeated every moment of my life for months. During some sessions, I could not speak. During others, I lay sobbing on the couch, exhausted from digging down to the roots of my pain. Therapy became a burden. Just a couple of months into it, I was through. I just didn't feel like having another big crying jag in that little fucking room. One Tuesday afternoon, I lay with the bed covers over my head, depressed and dreading therapy. As the hour approached, I decided I wasn't going and allowed myself to drift back into catatonia. 6 minutes after the appointment time, Rachel called. "Jennifer, are you on your way? Did you forget we had an appointment?" "What? Huh? You're supposed to be here in my office." I couldn't believe she spoke to me so directly. People rarely confronted me in that way. "I don't feel so well." Jennifer, it is disrespectful for you not to show up or call. I'm still in bed and I'm very fucking sick. Lying ass. What do you want me to do? Of course, Rachel knew I was full of it. She said she expected me in her office, pronto. During the entire drive there, I grumbled to myself about how unfairly I was being treated and how it was all bull anyway. When I arrived, Rachel said, "You have 20 minutes left." I felt like a damn fool, but I respected her for not taking my shit. Slowly, Rachel helped me to comprehend that the emotional scar tissue from my childhood had grown thick and heavy, blocking my ability to move forward in my life in a healthy way. She brought me to see that my mother's rage was not my fault, and that my own rage was a replication of my experiences with my mama. Journal entry. The reality of the darkness I've lived through is staggering. I have Mama's anger. I go off on people just like Mama used to go off on me. I just want to be better. God, please help me to stop being so scared all the time. I learned that treatment is not a smooth, straight path. I would see bright moments, but then become filled to the brim with anxiety and sadness, resolving it all in a drunken streak. My discussions with Rachel unearthed long-suppressed feelings that showed themselves in horrible dreams, my tears falling before I could wake. One time I fucked up an audition, I threatened to quit and leave the country for good. Rachel said something to me at the time that turned a light bulb on in my mind. When you're running, Jennifer, you take yourself with you. There was more. It wasn't just about my mother's anger, our poverty, or feeling unloved. Rachel told me what I had refused to admit to myself as I watched the movie Francis. She explained that I had a mental illness, more specifically, bipolar disorder. I sat there confused and skeptical as she talked about the disease, which formerly was called manic depression. According to the American Psychiatric Association, APA, people with bipolar disorder have extreme and intense emotional states that occur at distinct times called mood episodes that are categorized as manic, hypomanic, or depressive. People with bipolar disorders generally have periods of normal moods as well. Bipolar disorders can be treated, and people with these illnesses can lead full and productive lives. Say what now? Did she say a disorder? I had never heard the term bipolar. Okay, well, if you white people need to give this bullshit a name, whatever. I thought about poles, about opposites, about the Arctic and the Antarctic. I was dumbfounded when Rachel characterized my behavior as extreme. Had she said, "You're crazy," I would have agreed. But I've been crazy all my life. And when she said, "Mental illness," I thought, "Bitch, you crazy." I associated mental illness with people who couldn't function, with raving lunatics and straitjackets. What was I doing in therapy anyway? Black people don't go to therapy. Rachel told me that medical science believes bipolar disorder is partly caused by an imbalance of brain chemicals called neurotransmitters, such as serotonin and dopamine. Neuro what? Dopey who? She said these neurotransmitters affected our moods, Well, I certainly knew what a depressive mood was. But this other manic part was new. When Rachel explained the details, I gasped. She described me to a T. Mania? So that's what y'all call it? You mean there's a name for describing why I'm loud and talk fast and walk fast and feel like my brain is racing a million miles an hour? Is that why I rage, create drama, and speed when I drive? Compulsive, you say? The incessant doodling? The endless braiding and unbraiding my hair? Impulsive? The arguing with people and storming off, kicking shit, throwing shit? Yeah, okay. I guess all that describes me, but... Rachel broke it down for me because the concept of mania is sometimes more difficult to understand than the idea of depression. The American Psychiatric Association has the following definition. Mania, a distinct period of abnormally and persistently elevated, expansive, or irritable mood, and abnormally and persistently increased activity or energy, lasting at least a week and present most of the day, nearly every day. Whoa, whoa, wait a minute. Abnormal. Like in Young Frankenstein. I was uncomfortable and resistant, but I kept listening as Rachel talked about the symptoms that may occur during a manic episode. 1. Inflated self-esteem or grandiosity. Well, if I don't pump myself up, who will? 2. Decreased need for sleep. That's not me. I get at least 11 hours a night. 3. More talkative than usual or pressure to keep talking. Yeah, I do sometimes feel like I just have to keep spouting off or singing or cracking jokes. 4. Flight of ideas or subjective experience that thoughts are racing. Damn. Well, I guess I have sometimes felt like I can't catch up with the chaos in my brain. 5. Distractibility, i.e., attention too easily drawn to unimportant or irrelevant external stimuli. I admit, I've always had the attention of a fruit fly. 6. Increase in goal-directed activity. Look, I get things done. Something wrong with that? 7. Excessive involvement in pleasurable activities that have high potential for painful consequences. Wait a minute, what? Okay, so I like to drink a little, smoke a little, and get laid. Doesn't everybody? I mean, it's not like I ever did hard drugs. Even though I resisted the definition of manic symptoms, I had to admit, a lot of it described things I had been experiencing my entire life. Especially that last symptom about pleasurable activities. Rachel explained that people with bipolar disorder seek to relieve their depression or manic feelings by self-medicating. With behaviors that temporarily may impact the balance of the neurotransmitters in their brains. Actually, everybody does this. I mean, how many people do you know who smoke weed or drink wine every night when they get home? They do it to feel better. But because the brain chemistry of people with bipolar disease is out of whack, their relationship with their drug of choice gets out of whack. People with bipolar disorder typically self-medicate with gambling, food, drugs, alcohol, even overspending. It's often a combination of several of these. Well, My addiction was sex. I was a high-functioning addict who needed regular orgasms in order to get those neurotransmitters flowing. I heard Rachel and knew she was right. All of this described my life, my moods, my behavior. I began to realize that my hypersexuality was intertwined with my upbringing, bipolar disease, and my conflicted feelings about men. Just as alcoholism isn't really about the liquor, my addiction wasn't really about the sex. It was about unresolved psychological problems that caused me pain. Sex was simply my painkiller. By the time I entered therapy with Rachel, I had had more sex partners than I wanted to count. Therapy helped me understand why I felt compelled to have sex and how to use orgasms to prolong the joy and fulfillment I felt on stage. I knew from a young age that orgasms brought me peace, comfort, and relaxation. Now I had insight about the psychological and biological reasons behind it. I do not feel ashamed about my sexual history. I'm just amazed I'm still alive and healthy. Let me stop beating around the bush and share this little ditty. Ode to the Men. There was Hunky Butch, Nasty Bruce, and Silky Sexy Lanier, the Ethiopian in Boston who had to put it in my ear. James had a tongue as long as the Nile. John was high yellow with the sexiest smile. Lanier was my first at the tender age of 13. Caught him with Phyllis. That's sad Halloween. Dexter was my army boy. We did it on two chairs. Keep it down, fool. My mama's upstairs. There was Jesse, Jeffrey, Jimmy, and a dancer named Little Joe, who laid me down, flipped me over, but didn't dent my fro. Gary pulled my hair and had me in the closet. Maurice served up a beer can. No return, no deposit. Sawyer, Sam, Gregory, Tucker, Eric, Adam, and Ken. In the words of Sly Stone, the butcher, the baker, the drummer, and then. On tour in Detroit in the middle of a blizzard, so they had to cancel the show. He introduced himself as Scooby-Doo. Scooby-who? Scooby-Doo? Fuck it, let's go. The businessman, the boxer, and the one in the sauna. I beckoned him with my titties. Come here, baby. You wanna? On the top of the Empire State Building. Yes, even up there. Was anybody watching? Chop, please. I don't care. Don, Ron, Tyrone, Terrell, and I remember Rocky smoked a pipe. But it was Perry. Perry. Ooh, Perry was just ripe. There was a Mr. Gold, a Mr. Blue, and Mr. Green had lots of dough. Had them in Minnesota, North Dakota, and yes, I confess, I da-ho. Philip, Peter, Paul. Oh, yeah. And that crusty Brit. Was it Jeffrey? No, Nigel. No, Ed. No, Fred. I'm getting sick of this shit. There were some STDs and pregnancies. And y'all know I didn't give birth to no kids. The recklessness, meltdowns, and chaos left me on the skids. This madness lasted throughout the decades of the 80s. I share it in order to express to you ladies. Back then, I didn't know my body was a temple. How precious and fragile we are. I was blind, crippled.